Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In the current issue of Foreign Affairs, our guest this hour, Nadia Hashimi, writes, there are girls, there are boys, and then there are the Bacha Posh, a temporary third gender for girls who live as boys. The practice is very old. It's been used to navigate Afghanistan's deeply patriarchal society, which values sons over daughters. So it is a way for girls to dress as boys and be able to work outside the home, perhaps go to school. When you think about this happening, there are lots of perhaps psychological ramifications here. What happens if you get caught? And when is it okay to change back to being a girl? Some just are boys until they reach adolescence, and some kind of switch back after school. And it's really an interesting practice, and Nadia is going to talk to us about it. She's the author of the piece that is in the current issue of Foreign Affairs, and she, her parents were from Afghanistan, and her mother, they left in the early 70s. Both her parents were born in Afghanistan before the Soviet invasion. Her mother is the granddaughter of a notable Afghan poet, and she went to Europe to obtain a master's degree in civil engineering. Her father came to the U.S., and Nadia is a pediatrician, and she's also a novelist. She's written a debut novel, The Pearl That Broke Its Shell, and her second novel, When the Moon is Low, which follows the perilous journey of an Afghan family as they flee Taliban-controlled Kabul and fall into the dark world of the undocumented who are living in Europe. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Nadia. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well at K Dunn Show. Nadia, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Kathleen. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, our pleasure. And what a deeply interesting article this is. I had no idea this was going on. And you say the practice is at least a century old?
From my research, it seems that it's about a century old. And it's very hard to find any kind of solid information or documentation about the practice specifically, because it's done in a corner of the world where we don't have a lot of documentation. Even in current Afghanistan, we don't really have demographics on how often this practice is conducted and you know, exactly where in the country. But just anecdotally, we know it's been around for a long time. A lot of people sometimes get the misconception that this is something that came out of, you know, the Taliban regime of Afghanistan being so restrictive against women, but it's really something that predated that.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're born a girl or if you're born a boy in Afghanistan, your life is going to be wholly different in terms of how far you travel, what work you can do, how educated you are. What a huge difference for male and female.
Indeed, and I think that's what makes this Bacha Posh practice so interesting to look at, because it really does tell the tale of the difference between the two genders in Afghanistan. For me, for example, when I sat down to write my novel, my goal was really to talk about what it meant to be a girl in Afghanistan and to talk about that gender disparity. And it occurred to me that the best way to do that would be through the eyes of a child who has lived both as a girl and as a boy, because they have a very unique perspective on the difference between those two different genders. So I really wanted to use the Bacha Posh practice as a vehicle to talk about gender. But looking at the practice on its own, it is so fascinating that people have really taken a closer look at it and become so intrigued by it as a phenomenon on itself.
Mm-hmm. So do most families decide that their female is going to be dressed as a boy and act like a boy from birth on, or are most of the Bacha Posh going from girl to boy each day?
There's not a lot of formality to the practice. There's a good deal of diversity with exactly how it's conducted within each family. There are a few kind of basic tenets to the practice, though. One is that a young girl who is chosen to become a boy or to be disguised as a boy for a time, it's usually done in the early years. I've know some people who have started it at birth, and then there are others who start it more around school age. And that can vary depending on, you know, what the circumstances are within the family.
And now
the overall tradition is, is that it should really end before that child hits puberty or nears puberty, because at that stage, then gender takes on a whole other meaning in Afghanistan. And once you start to develop sexual characteristics, then you become a very different creature and you can't really pass through this, you know, amorphous land.
It must be so amazingly hard, though, to make the transition. If you've had all of this freedom, you can swing from trees and go to school and sell things on the corner to bring money home for the family and play sports, play soccer, to make a transition from having all of this freedom to having to be inside the house and not being able to enjoy sports or sometimes school must be incredibly hard on young women, isn't it?
From what we know, again, all of it is anecdotal as we're collecting kind of, you know, each one of us is researching and looking into this now. There are different kinds of experiences. So some young girls decide that they themselves want to go back to being a girl. Some have gone on to transition fairly peacefully and fairly seamlessly and go back to absorbing, you know, that female persona and taking on the female traditional roles, and then later in life, you know, getting married and raising children. Others struggle with it more. And the most extreme that I have heard of is I spoke with someone who's a friend of a Bachapoosh who's still living as a Bachapoosh, even though she's here in the United States right now, and who's actually been pursuing gender reassignment surgery. And, you know, how much of that is a result of her experience living as a boy and having that sort of entrenched in her and having a very deep psychological impact, it's hard to say, but it seems like there would be some sort of role in her experience dressing as a boy for a time.
And I would imagine gender reassignment surgery is unheard of in Afghanistan.
As far as I know, I've never heard of anyone pursuing it over there. So it seems that this individual, specifically because she has been living in the United States, is able to pursue that as an option.
Are most of the young girls who are involved in this, you write about 25% of children in Afghanistan between 6 and 17, that's pretty young, are working outside the home. They're selling things on the street or pens or gum or things like that. And I'm wondering if it means that this Bachapoosh custom then is something that is more popular among those who don't have as much money so they can go out and sell things on the corner.
So again, it's really hard to pinpoint exactly, you know, where how much of the intersection between child labor is with the Bachapoosh custom. In speaking with my family and friends, and I have a very large extended family, my husband, you know, grew up and was raised in Afghanistan as well, so I have his family to tap into as well as resources. And when you speak with the Afghan community and you speak with the different people who had Bachapoosh in their families, a lot of it was not done really for economic reasons or for those kinds of practical reasons. It seems that the majority of the families who engaged in the Bachapoosh practice actually did so because of just the simple valuing of having a son. And so a lot of them, what they would do is, you know, look at their family of just daughters, and there's a superstition that if you dress one of your daughters as a boy, that will bring good fortune to your home so that the next child naturally born into the home will be a true son.
Hmm.
And so that just speaks to, you know, the differential in terms of value of son versus daughter within the culture.
Mm-hmm. And it must be understood, because you know about this, and people in Afghanistan must know that this is happening, do they, or are they trying to root it out?
There's an understanding that this happens in the background, that this is part of the culture. What's interesting is, you know, as I started to put this book together and talk to different people within my family and friends network about it, people who were born and raised in Afghanistan, they all seem to say, well, yes, sure, I knew one. I have a cousin who was one. I have two cousins who was one. There was one in my school. So everyone has this almost one degree of separation from a Bachapoosh. And they had not really considered it as an odd practice, I think, because it was common enough and happening in the background that it was sort of absorbed as normal or as, you know, something that was acceptable and tolerated. And it wasn't until, I think, you know, we start looking at it through a very different lens that the Afghans that I was speaking to are looking back on it and saying, you know what, I guess it was sort of a curious thing that we did in that country. And the circumstances were very different, obviously. So now that people are living here, that kind of practice doesn't happen at all, that, to my knowledge, in the United States.
Well, and as you say in the article, it's mystifying. Is it ever mystifying that a society with such strict definitions of gender can permit a guise as superficial as cross-dressing to instantly liberate girls and give them opportunities reserved for boys?
It is. It seems like a contradiction, and that would be the last place in the world that simply dressing as a boy would allow a child to have such different liberties, such freedoms. But, you know, by the same token, maybe it's because Afghanistan has been so strict in its gender roles that it really had to create an out. It's almost as if the society as a whole, by placing such devaluation on girls and, you know, having families with only daughters, having them feel such a void or a loss, had to provide also a solution for those families. And this is a very interesting way of going about solving that problem.
It sure is. And you say that there's little fanfare if you're pre-adolescent and you are discovered, but what happens if you're an adolescent Bachapush?
So an adolescent Bachapush is now pushing those boundaries. As I mentioned before, there's no manual for, you know, if you want to raise a Bachapush, here are the 10 rules on how to do it. It's really a custom that people understand. It's done just for childhood, where there's a lot more fluidity and children can sort of be children in different ways. But once you have a young girl who's an adolescent, that's a whole different creature. Now, that is a creature who has very specific roles within the society and has very specific behaviors that are appropriate versus not appropriate. So a young woman who is now dressing as a boy is going to be engaged in activities that are not okay, that are, you know, outside of the norms for her within Afghan culture. And that's when she's going to, you know, the family is going to be getting some frowns from their neighbors.
Mm-hmm. I just am thinking of that moment where you've been a boy all this time and now all of a sudden you have to be a girl in a society that doesn't value girls as much as boys, and I just can't imagine how rough it would be.
I think that part is truly very difficult. And adolescence in general is a transition period. You know, when I look at it through my pediatrician eyes, adolescence is all about transition and trying to see what your potential is and test your boundaries. And so that, on top of this gender issue, just creates another layer of complex feelings for that individual who's already struggling with their own identity and with trying to find their place in the world.
Mm-hmm. As you know, in the United States, all of a sudden we're getting a lot of stories about young children who feel as though they were born in the wrong sex and that it develops very, very early, and that you have to encourage that in some ways in order to have a child who can be healthy. You talk about altering the gender identity of a developing child can have a deep psychological impact. Do we know what the impact has been in Afghanistan, or has that not been studied?
We don't know because it hasn't been studied. And, you know, as we all have sort of heard to some varying extent, Afghanistan's been in a state of turmoil for the past few decades. And in that state of turmoil, there's been very little, you know, there really aren't the resources for looking into something as, you know, relatively insignificant as this tradition that happens in the background. It's very transient. It's very quiet. A girl is transformed into a boy, and then she's transformed back into a girl, and, you know, for whatever reasons it might be. And so there hasn't really even been, at times, a very structured government in Afghanistan. So there is nobody, there is no organization to take a look and see how extensive is this practice, at what age are people starting it, what are the reasons exactly that they're doing it, and, you know, what is the impact on these girls long-term or for that immediate time period, how are families contributing to the adjustment and the readjustment. There are anecdotal reports, but there is no formal study or, you know, sociological study of it.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Nadia, and here's how you reach our conversation. We're talking about Afghanistan's female sons, the tradition, and an interesting one it is, of Bacha Posh. Nadia Hashimi is a pediatrician. She's also a novelist, and she wrote a piece that's in Foreign Affairs this month about this practice and what it means for the girls and boys and why it's done, and she also writes about women making some inroads in Afghan society, but saying at the end of the article, unless fathers can hoist their young daughters on their shoulders and be as proud of them as they are of their sons, that these kinds of things will continue. And it's an unusual practice, don't you think? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can find us on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow at this time, we'll talk about the very interesting growing trend of adult coloring books. They look like so much fun. Our guest will be Sori Hong, and she has curated a coloring book titled Outside the Lines. It features the work of more than 100 contemporary artists, and seven of the top 20 Amazon best-selling books are coloring books. What's that all about? Although it sounds like fun. We'll talk about why people are rediscovering coloring at older ages tomorrow at 2 o'clock. All right, let's go to phone calls. And Mike in Marshfield is our first caller for you. Hi, Mike.
Hello. They have, if not the same practice, a very similar practice in the mountain regions, which is just about everywhere, in Albania. And I attribute it to an acute shortage of male personnel, heads of household, from time to time, because the history has been so difficult there. And then the other thing is the traditional folk law prior to World War II, prior to communism, was called canon law or canon law. It's not like canon law from Rome, but K-A-N-N-U-N. And canon law means that as a female, you can't inherit any property from your father. Your father can give you any gift he wants to give you when he's alive, and that'll be honored. But once he's dead, you inherit nothing because you're a female, and you need to be a male to inherit. Well, with there not being enough men to go around, and they need people to actually play the role of men as heads of household, and then I think that this transgender assignment of the female also allows for inheritance. Now, I'm not an expert on this, but I just got back from Albania.
Oh, you
and,
did. Oh.
And I, to hear her talk about mountain people, I'm pretty sure mountain people have to keep a very tight leash on everything because they don't have any money. And when you can capture one, you can't tax him. So the further up the mountain you go, the harder it is to rule over there.
Mm-hmm.
And the more they have their own ways of doing things, which work pretty well for them. But sometimes they're so poor they can't afford things, luxuries like a national government.
Mm-hmm.
One last note. Ancient symbol, pictogram for anarchy was a goat head, because you can capture a shepherd and you can tax him, and you can capture a dairyman and you can tax him, but it's hard to find a goat herd, and when you do, well, you know, you didn't have any money anyway. But that there's the news
From
the
Albania.
Empire.
Yeah, thank you very much for the news from Albania. We don't get a lot of it. Nadia.
Yes, I've read about the sworn out. They're called the Sworn Virgins of Albania. And there are some photographs of them that you can find online. And it's quite remarkable when you look at this. And these are women who've really just taken on the persona of men, and they have decided that they never want to marry in their lives, and they will live the rest of their lives out as men. And you know, a lot of them, they just carry themselves as men, and they just absorb that persona. So it's a fascinating practice, and I think that it will, you probably find, you know, random people practicing it in other parts of the world as well. Very recently on Huffington Post, it was an article about a woman who is in Egypt, actually, who after her husband passed away, she had a family to support, and she decided to start dressing as a man so that she could work outside the house. I believe she was a shoe repair person. And she's been working since that time. She's now, you know, well past middle age, and has just recently gotten an award for her work, just being so dedicated to her family and working so hard. And she continues to dress as a man. So, you know, there are little pockets of this everywhere else. But the biggest population that I've heard of outside of Afghanistan, I do hear about it happening in Pakistan as well. But the sworn virgins of Albania would be a really interesting population to look at as well.
Yeah. There are some interesting pictures in Foreign Policy. Were any of these young girls reluctant to have their pictures taken? Was it hard to get pictures of them?
Those pictures were taken by another photographer. So that question I wouldn't be able to answer. I know that the people that I've spoken to, people are reluctant to give, you know, to have their names associated with it. A lot of them, especially because I am of Afghan descent, because I do have an extended Afghan family, I feel like they are reluctant to be willing to post a lot of their personal information, you know, via either my website or my Facebook page or anywhere else. So, and I've tried to respect people's privacies and not really push them to give that information. I think photographs are so compelling to look at because it is a very physical transition. So we want to see, what does a girl look like dressed as a boy? And can you tell? Can you not tell? What is she wearing?
Yes.
How is she carrying herself? But because I am so, you know, deeply within the Afghan community, I've tried to really respect people's privacies and not post pictures. So I'm glad there are photographers out there who are managing to capture these images.
Angie is our next caller in Eau Claire. Hi, Angie.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just adore your show.
Thanks.
I was calling because I was just thinking about trying to put, as a mother, myself in a mother's shoes there in that country and that culture. And isn't it a way to think about it as a form of love? If you let your, you want your child to have more opportunity, and this is happening when they're younger, it, to me, it almost seems like a mother that might have a healthy maternal instinct and wants her daughter to have more opportunity. Just that idea of running out and playing. I mean, if I was forced to not allow my child to do that, it would be very difficult. So I wonder if she had any contact with mothers, with the actual maternal people that were involved that did this, and their answer to that. And I kind of think if it's an open secret, is this a way for women to kind of subvert their situation and allow their children to kind of, you know, be free?
That's an interesting question. Nadia?
That is an interesting question. Mm-hmm. The experience I've talked to mostly have been the people who have actually lived this way themselves. So it's hard to say what the parents were specifically thinking. But to your point, I don't get the sense from my interviews that these were families who had any sort of malicious intent towards their daughters. It was either really looking at the big picture of what was in the best interest of the family. And, you know, if they did this practice in order to bring some good fortune so that a true son would be born, it was really not as an individual sense of pride, but rather as, you know, a source of pride for the family. So this would be something that they would engage in for the family. And also, there wasn't really a whole lot of thought given to that, you know, there's a possibility of this being a very difficult transition for their daughter down the road. I don't think people really intended to put their daughters through a very tough time in adolescence. And I don't think that, you know, this engaging in this practice makes anyone necessarily a bad parent, because it has to be taken in context. It's within the landscape of Afghanistan. The culture is very different. You know, there are varying education levels. So you don't really have a lot of people who are looking at the issues that we look at here. For example, when we think about how can I best nurture my developing child and how should I think about gender, we have the luxury of being able to think about those things. In Afghanistan, people are thinking about very different things on a day-to-day basis. And so, you know, I don't think parents really walk into this with negative intent for their daughters. And a lot of them, as you're suggesting, are probably saying, you know, I think my daughter will actually enjoy this for a while. And I have heard some mothers have picked daughters who specifically have a bit more spunky personalities or personalities that sometimes here we might call it a tomboy. And so those girls would be a really good fit for engaging in the practice of a betcha push for some time.
Thank you, Angie, for your call. Lorraine in Minnesota. Hi, Lorraine.
Hi. You know, this is a global situation, including the U.S. of A. I grew up as a child, the only daughter in a household with two brothers. And starting from my earliest memories, I was told not to bother my brothers. And I don't think that this was the intention of my parents, but it also led my brothers to not pay much attention to me as if that was inappropriate. And I didn't know it at the time, but I think I was my father's favorite. Others have told me I was, and that I was the brightest one of those children. And yet my brothers were more important. I grew up to be a woman who wasn't very sure of her sexuality, and I felt neuter as a young woman for quite some time.
Hmm. And were your brothers given the benefits of education and all of that?
Yes, but so was I.
I see. It's just that their thoughts or whatever they were doing was more important than what you were doing.
Yes, and, you know, it was clear in my household that my father was the most important person, and interactions kind of tended to go through him, and that was because my mother was, you know, an opposite personality, not at all dominant, and so on. So it's never one single factor that determines these things. But, you know, in the United States of America, women couldn't vote until the 1920,
right.
And they couldn't own their own property. I don't know when that changed. So this isn't just foreign.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm just saying, and it persists to this day.
Mm-hmm.
I recall when I lived in the city of Chicago seeing a father, and I would say these were young teen children, a father and a brother poking at a young girl, and she just out on a sidewalk, and she was trying to treat it as a game, but she was clearly very upset, and they were enjoying it.
Hmm. Nadia.
You know, I'm really thankful that you're bringing this up. I think there's a lot of value in looking at a practice like the betcha push practice, specifically because, and this was my dream for looking at the betcha push practice, was to really highlight the inequalities between the genders and how we look at gender. We do a better job of it here in the United States, but we're still far from perfect. And I've had the privilege now of being able to talk to people of all different ages and from all over the country. And it's funny, often enough, it will come up again and again from people who are, you know, have been Americans for several generations, that they remember a time in their lives, actually, too, that they experienced that differential, that being less than what the brothers in the household were. And it may not be exactly the same way that we talk about in the Afghan culture, but it's there. And so there are lots of different ways of looking at the problem and kind of introspecting a little bit and understanding, are we doing as good a job that we would hope to do here? I read an article recently talking about the chastity balls that they have and that people are still having in some parts of the country, and these young women, you know, coming out as these debutantes, but, you know, promising that they will remain chaste until they're married. And there was a bit of criticism there, you know, this idea that the girl belongs to her father until she is passed off onto a husband, and then her husband really has claim to her. We've also heard different things about, you know, some of the more extreme or conservative religions that are not Muslim religions, but other religions as well, where women are deemed almost as property of the man, and they must obey their husband, they must obey their spouse, you know, regardless of what he may be doing. So I think when we take a step back and look at a bigger picture, there's a common thread that, as you mentioned, can be followed through different parts of the world, not just the United States or Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Lorraine, for your call. We have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation with Nadia. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. The article also takes a look at what's happening with women in Afghanistan. Now, you do say that, you know, there's some breakthroughs here, that girls are taking up sports like mountain climbing, traditionally male sports, that you're seeing female taxi drivers, pilots, politicians, who are, though, bravely defying tradition at great personal cost. How many are defying tradition, and what is the cost?
So the numbers, again, are so hard to track, especially because we're looking at women who are doing things in lots of different ways to reestablish the role of a woman in Afghanistan's culture. And, you know, as you mentioned, there's that really wonderful piece on NPR actually did on Afghan girls who are training as mountain climbers, for example, others who are women who are engaging in politics or other fields. So it's very hard to pinpoint how many women are doing anything that's, you know, really challenging what has been the status quo for women in Afghanistan in the recent years. I think what is important is that the trend seems to be moving in that direction. And, you know, the greatest pockets of change are really being seen within the cities. They are more open to women having a different role in Afghanistan's public forum. But at the same time, that is starting to trickle out to the outlying areas and into the villages. And that change will be slow in coming. But, you know, these women are really making strides that are so important, not for themselves, but also for the next generation, because there will be people who will look up to these women or girls, and not only girls. I mean, they're not only young girls who will look up to them and decide that maybe I can do something different because I see somebody ahead of me doing it. But it's important also to think about the young boys that are being exposed,
yes,
to strong and courageous women, because it's important for them to understand that women can do these things, have that potential, and should be permitted to do these things, or even encouraged to participate in different activities. So if we have a generation of young boys seeing their older sisters, their mothers, their aunts being engaged in politics or in professional careers, then that becomes the norm. And in my opinion, once that becomes the norm and the value of a woman changes and comes much closer to that of a man, then, you know, something like the Bachapush custom will really become archaic and outdated.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit more about your parents. They were born in Afghanistan, left in the early 70s. It must have been difficult to leave. Tell me the circumstances under which they did leave and what ties your whole family has to Afghanistan now.
My parents were fortunate in that they left Afghanistan before this tumultuous time period really began. And as you mentioned earlier, my father came to the United States with the intention of working to support his extended family. So he was here thinking that he would be here only for a few years and then return home and finish his studies. My mother came to Afghanistan via Europe. She was engaged to my father at the time and then came here, joined him here after obtaining her master's degree. And they were married in New York and started working. And within a couple of years, Afghanistan took a very quick downward spiral with the invasion of the Soviet Union. And so they, you know, it wasn't a safe time for them to return, and they ended up staying in the United States and then establishing roots here. And I think it's hard for anyone to live in a new country without eventually establishing some pretty deep roots, and that's what they did. They were happy to be here, eager to be working and be part of society. And so we had contact with family in Afghanistan. We had a great deal of family leave Afghanistan during the years that followed, and so there was a trickle of family coming out and kind of going to different areas of the world, really. So I grew up having family in India and Australia, Africa, throughout Europe.
Oh, goodness.
Pretty much everywhere, which is incredible because I was able to travel to a lot of places to go visit family, and that was a wonderful experience, seeing other lands and other cultures as well, and seeing how people were living in other places after having to flee their own country for those types of reasons. It's very, very valuable lesson mm-hmm. to learn. Of course, we still had family within Afghanistan, and the amount of contact with them during the time period of war was limited due to not only just the war, but also technology during that time period wasn't the way it is right now. Now everybody's got a cell phone and everyone's Skyping, so it's very different. But we were able to stay in contact, and my father had brothers who were still living in Afghanistan, raising their families there.
Mm-hmm. So you've been able to go back with your parents?
Yes, I went back with my parents there. And it was a really interesting trip back because for my parents, they were going back to a land, you know, 30-plus years later that they could barely recognize. And in return, the land base barely recognized them as well. So Afghans returning, those are Afghans from the diaspora, and the people who had lived in Afghanistan through the years of war. It was a very new population that was in Kabul where my parents had been living prior. And when I walked through the streets of Kabul with my parents, you could feel the eyes on us, and people could tell that we were from somewhere else. And so even for my parents, who really were from that land, born and raised in that country, going back, there was this feeling of distance, of separation, that they'd been apart from it for so long. At the same time, it was a wonderful trip because they were able to reunite with family and see places that they hadn't seen, and you know, walk through old childhood homes and touch structures of buildings. You know, my mother's family home was no longer standing, but she was at least able to stand on the land of it. So it was a very bittersweet trip overall.
Yes. I understand that Afghanistan at one point, probably when your parents were growing up there, was a very, very beautiful place.
It really was, and when you see the pictures of it, and I think that's what surprises people, that I have been able to share some pictures of Afghanistan during other time periods, and people are surprised to see pictures of things like fashion shows or parades, and see that, you know, or family pictures from when my mother was growing up in Afghanistan, and see that she and her sisters were all dressed in clothing that anybody here in the United States would wear, in jeans and skirts and, you know, tops, and that nobody in her family, people were not wearing head covers at all. So it surprises people that there was that time period in Afghanistan, especially in the capital and in the cities. It's not to say that, you know, life was the same in all areas of the country, but there was a very different life in Afghanistan during that time.
Let's go to Nita in Gurnee. Hi.
Hi. I understand we're talking mostly about Afghanistan, but I'm wondering if your guest knows of how many countries or which countries, besides the British Crown, of course, are where the head of state is a female, and where the country, you know, does not discriminate. In other words, they may promote or at the very least not discriminate against women achieving.
Oh, that's a great question. A very tough question to answer. Someone asked me recently, I was doing a book club chat over Skype, and somebody asked me, are women in Afghanistan able to work without any kind of harassment? And I said, my answer to that was, are women anywhere able to work without any kind of harassment? And so I have basically the same answer here. I don't really know if it's possible for women in any country to really feel completely on par with their male counterparts. If we look in general at the Western world, we still hear about men leading the way and women sort of being that traditionally that figure that stays at home or is less capable, or, you know, she's got children. So we look at things like that. We hear the talk in the United States about, you know, Hillary Clinton is a grandmother and how much focus is placed on that. So I don't really know of any cultures specifically or any countries where women are encouraged or really desired as heads of state. And we do have, in South America there is, but I still there think that there, even in a country where you do have a female president, there are issues with how encouraged women are to take on leadership roles.
Thank you very much, Anita, for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Nadia Hashimi is our guest. She's a pediatrician, and she's also a novelist. She is the author of two books, The Pearl That Broke Its Shell, released last year, and her second novel, When the Moon is Low, which follows the journey, difficult journey, dangerous journey, of an Afghan family as they flee Taliban-controlled Kabul and fall into the world of the undocumented living in Europe. She wrote a piece for Foreign Policy magazine that looks at this practice, which we've discovered during the course of the hour is not just in Afghanistan, but it's a really interesting practice of dressing for a variety of reasons, mainly economic. It's a way to get out of the house. If you're a young girl, you dress as a boy. Sometimes parents do this when they're babies, and they remain boys until they are adolescent, and then you must become a girl at that point in time, or severe retribution will follow. But it's kind of, people look the other way. They know what's happening, but up until those years, you live a different kind of life because you can run around outside, you can play sports, you go to school, you have a much less restricted life than if you are a girl in Afghanistan. You can go on the streets and add to the family income by selling sticks of gum or things like that. And so she looks at this practice in this Foreign Policy magazine. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Couple lines are open if you'd like to still join our conversation. 800-486-8655 is the number for you to call. Nadia, do you have a sense of, we keep hearing reports every now and then, as you know, in the United States about what the situation is for young girls in Afghanistan. What's happened with schooling? Are there more girls now who can go to school, or are restrictions lifted and then they're clamped down on again?
The restrictions were lifted very quickly after the Taliban were ousted from Afghanistan and from the major cities. So that was a success story, and that was one of the driving forces that the United States and Western nations had advocated for going into Afghanistan, was really to liberate the women and the girls from the oppressive Taliban regime. And so that mission was accomplished. At this point now, 36% of students on average in Afghan schools, if you look at the entire country, about 36% of the students enrolled are girls. And so, that may not be a perfect number. It might not be the 50% that we would want to hear, but that's a very good number considering where we're coming from. If you look at the percentage of girls in schools in the cities, I'm sure it's going to be very different than it is from the villages. And so in the villages, any girls that aren't going to school, their reasons may be economic, that the parents need those children at home to help them with younger children, to help care for the younger children, don't have the ability to, feed them, or may need them to do small labor or true child labor in order to supplement the family's income. Or there may be cultural reasons that family chooses not to educate their daughters. And, the government will have a hard time forcing families to send their daughters to school if that particular family does not want to do that. But there really aren't any formal restrictions on behalf of the government. The government is actually encouraging children of both genders to attend school.
Mm-hmm. And going back to the women who defy the social norms and are girls instead of, or boys instead of girls, you write about the fact that they are often deemed less desirable as wives. They have developed reputations for being stubborn and difficult, or having had a history of inappropriate interactions with boys.
Well, to clarify, if a girl has gone on past adolescence and engages in the Bachapush practice, this was sort of a theoretical, what would happen if a girl engaged in this Bachapush practice, and would she be desirable as a wife? And so when you look at who's planning marriages, a lot of marriages now in Afghanistan are arranged by the young people themselves who are meeting either in school or in some other kind of public forum, and maybe not dating in the American sense of the term, but getting to know each other in some form. There are others who are going to be arranged by their parents, and so usually what happens is that a mother will know that her son is getting to that age where she wants to find the right partner for him. And so she'll be looking around at the women within her community, the girls of appropriate age within her community. And so imagining a mother-in-law looking around at the potentials, if she's looking at a girl who's been dressed as a bachapush, you know, into adolescence and has passed that mark where we usually expect that girls are transitioned back, then that's probably a girl who's a bit more bold, who's a bit more defiant, who feels that she's entitled to different things than other girls would be. And so for a mother-in-law who's imagining bringing this girl into the home or into, you know, her family unit, that might not be the best option, because you really want to bring somebody in who's going to grow with your family and kind of work with what your family needs and not be a source of dissent or defiance.
I would think that it would be a mark against you if you have to switch roles and become this, fit in, do what the family needs to be a part of our unit, that just considering how different the experience is for boys and girls, and even more so in the not-too-distant past here, that you would have all of this freedom. So you might call it boisterousness or defiance or whatever. You've just had a lot of freedom, so I would think that you would be less desirable pretty much across the board, because freedom makes you feel that you can say what you want to say and you can go outside when you want to go outside.
It's possible. Again, it's so different. So if you have a young girl who is dressed as a boy, you know, from the age of, let's say, 4 to 8 years old, and then she's changed back, you know, I don't know if any mother-in-law is really going to look at her when she's 18 and pick out any differences or discriminate against her. And it's a very theoretical situation, because it's going to vary so much depending on who that child was, what year she was a bachapush, how she's transitioned, and who the mother-in-law is, what expectations she has. So there's a lot of variables going into that situation.
And I wonder how many who were bachapushes and become mothers jump at the chance to have their daughters do the same, or if they shy away from it.
That would be an interesting study to do, to see, you know, if you took a look at all the girls who have lived as a boy, who have dressed, you know, have been a bachapush, and interviewed them, and would you recommend this for your child? I'd be really interested to see overall, you know, what the take would be from these girls, because there is an argument to be made in either direction, either that it was too difficult a transition or an untransition.
Right.
Or that it was so good to experience that time period that it was worth it.
Yeah. Well, you've had an interesting life, haven't you? You have these two careers going on, both of which are demanding, being a pediatrician, and you're also a novelist.
I am, yes. I'm very fortunate. I sometimes describe it as being invited to two different really great parties on the same night and not knowing which to go to. So I have been really fortunate, and I've loved being a pediatrician. I've loved my training in pediatrics. I chose pediatrics specifically because I love working with children. They have a very special spirit about them, a resilience. They get better a lot more often than adults do, which makes it nice. And at the same time, you know, when I finished my training, I have a husband who has really been very supportive and encouraging and pushed me to sort of pursue this very quiet aspiration of writing and storytelling. And over time, we have found a way to really balance those two things so that they can both fit into our lives. And it's been a really rewarding experience. And I've actually been thinking about it. And sometimes I think that, you know, medicine is not that far off from storytelling, really, because it's in both. You really have to pay attention to what people are saying, to listen to their stories. As a storyteller, I need to listen to people in order to be able to tell that story. I have to create a character and then listen to what that character is feeling it's reading between the lines a lot of times. You know, what you're hearing is not really what's going on. There's a lot more. And so there's a lot of common threads, really, between the world of storytelling and mm-hmm. the world of medicine.
Thank you, Nadia, so much for being with us. Fascinating story. Nadia Hashimi and her piece is in Foreign Affairs, Afghanistan's Female Sons, the Tradition of Bajapush is the name of the story. And thanks to KP Whaley for producing The Hour and to KP for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. News is coming up. We're with you again tomorrow, same time, 1 until 3 Central Time to follow. Thanks very much for listening.